Hello, everyone. Welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Rita Peters, here with my co-host, Mark Meckler. And we're going to be talking once again today about the crisis at America's border. We've said it before, and we'll say it again now. This is something that we should all be very concerned about, whether you live near the border or not. As people who are called to love our neighbor and to do justice, surely we cannot turn a blind eye to the suffering that is being caused by hordes of people trying to enter our country illegally. And before I introduce our distinguished guests, because we are in for a very interesting and educational conversation today, but Mark, you're a Texan, so just remind our audience about what's happening at the border right now.
Yeah, I live in Central Texas, so I'm about 4 hours, say, from the border, roughly 4.5 hours. And we are being, for lack of a better term, and I think appropriate term, being invaded. We are being invaded by hostiles. And I know the media portrays many of these people as people just coming for economic opportunity. And I think there is truth in that. But we are also being invaded by very well-organized, completely militarized criminal gangs that are bringing so much fentanyl across the border that we're seeing the deaths of upwards of 100,000 Americans every year. We're seeing women and children sex trafficked. And I hate that term. What we're seeing is human slavery on a scale not seen in human history. And I think this is really important. And it's important for our listeners because we talk about, obviously, Judeo-Christian values and the Judeo-Christian ethic of America. Important to remember that in history, in human history, ethical monotheism, the introduction of ethical monotheism through Judaism, is the reason that we have our code of ethics that we have in Western society. Whether somebody is a Jew or a Christian or a non-believer, they live in a society that's benefited from the Judeo-Christian code of ethics, which comes out of ethical monotheism. And so for our listeners, I think what's really important is to understand that this is an issue of morality and justice. It is not just an issue of border security or crime. And so we want to make sure that though we look at it from very practical reasons of crime and border security and national security, that we also always think about the angles of morality and justice when we're talking about this issue.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, the specific question we're exploring today is whether the states have legal authority to protect their borders from this invasion by illegal immigrants. To help us do that, we have with us Professor Rob Nadelson, a true constitutional expert and historian. He was a law professor for 25 years. He's currently the Independence Institute Senior Fellow in Constitutional Jurisprudence and a contributor for the Epoch Times. His scholarly works have been repeatedly cited by the U.S. Supreme Court, federal appellate courts, and at least 16 state Supreme Courts. He is truly an expert, truly a scholar, a historian, an author. Rob, welcome to Crossroads.
It's great to be with you, Rita. Mark?
Well, Rob, I'm going to start with the broad question. You wrote a 5-part series, I believe, in Epoch Times about this issue on the border and about the authority of states to enforce borders and immigration laws and repel invasions. But I want to start with something broader, which I opened with in my opening, which is, it seems to me that this is an issue beyond the law, beyond the Constitution. This is an issue of morality and justice. And could you talk to us from that perspective to open?
Well, the most obvious issue of justice has to do with the fact that people who come to this country legally are being hurt. Other folks are going to the front of the line. It's a canard, it's a common saying to say that America is a country of immigrants. My mother was an immigrant. My grandparents on my father's side were immigrants, but they came here legally. And so you have a lot of people cutting across the border. Related to that is the failure of the Biden administration to enforce the law. The law is a foundation, as you know, of biblical morality. It's a foundation of liberty. You cannot have a civilized society without the rule of law.
Yeah, and one quick thing, Rita, and then I'll flip it to you. We're living this in Texas right now. I live in Central Texas, as I said, and we feel it here in our area. Our schools are overrun with the children of illegal immigrants. And of course, our hearts go out to children always. Our hospitals are overrun. We have hospitals in Texas that are shutting down because they just can't afford to treat all of these people. Our law enforcement is being overrun, so our communities are unsafe because our sheriffs and local law enforcement can't respond to everything that's going on. So from a moral perspective, I would argue also, we're just not protecting our own citizens, and our government at its core has an obligation, a moral obligation, to protect our citizens.
There's also the effect on the illegal immigrants themselves. I mean, when Robert F. Kennedy, one of the few Democrats to actually go down to the border and look to see, came back and reported, he reported that the border agents had shown him across the Rio Grande River where there was a tree, which was called the rape tree. And this is the tree under which the criminal gangs that smuggle illegal immigrants exact their price from young women. That's one indication of the moral crisis that we're facing.
So it's clear, as people of faith, people who believe it's our duty to love and care for our neighbors, we can't just ignore what's going on. But really, the question is, what can we do about it? What can anyone do about it? And we know that the immigration crisis has hit Texas especially hard. And Texas officials have started working to protect their own borders since the Biden administration has failed to do that. And Rob, some law professors seem to be outraged by the idea that a state would have the gumption to protect itself against the unchecked flow of illegal immigrants. So I want to get to their legal arguments in a minute. But first, you talked in your Epoch Times article about their tactics. And you said that it harkens back to tactics they used when Obamacare was being debated. Tell us a little bit about the tactics and why you object to those.
Well, the first thing to understand about law professors is that they're overwhelmingly left of center. I mean, better than 90%.
Yeah.
The second thing to understand about them is that they are the most ignorant of academics. This is true. And I admit this as a former law professor. Most law professors have no training in areas outside the law. They have no training in teaching. They have no training in research skills beyond what is minimally necessary to write a court brief. Most have no particular training in related areas like history or sociology or economics. And because they are so far left of center, and because they live in an echo chamber where they think that everything that they believe is self-evidently correct, they're not particularly scrupulous about disregarding facts and research before making statements. Mm-hmm. So one of the techniques that you asked about, Rita, is the technique of simply saying, you know, the Constitution is absolutely clear. The states have no reserved war powers whatsoever. They have no right or power to stem the invasion whatsoever. And anyone who thinks to the contrary is obviously a dolt. I've run across several articles by law professors along that line, and it was clear to me that these folks had never actually researched the issue of reserved state war powers or examine what the Constitution meant when it referred to an invasion. They did use a similar tactic, Rita, during the Obamacare controversy. They argued that the mandate that everyone buy government-prescribed insurance was clearly, use that word again, clearly constitutional, clearly given to Congress by the commerce power. And as it turned out, the court actually ruled that the mandate was not justified by the commerce power. It was upheld under the taxing clause, but that's not what the law professors were arguing. And so when you see an op-ed by a law professor, present company accepted, take it with a barrel of salt until you know that the person really has some background in what he or she is talking about.
Yeah, so the tactic basically is you claim something is clear and obvious, and that anyone who doesn't know that is crazy or stupid or something. And that's your argument.
It's obvious. It's well within the commerce power. You know, this is a rhetorical debating technique, and it really has nothing to do with the realities of constitutional law.
Yeah.
Rob, I want to go through the three sort of main arguments that they make. I want to go through them one at a time. And first is the opponents of state action say that Texas or any other state that would do this is actually nullifying federal law. How would you respond to that?
Very simply, Texas is enforcing federal law.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this is one of those places where maybe you as a law professor can say it's obvious, right? And clear and unequivocal. Texas is just trying to enforce federal law. They're not doing any more than the federal government could or actually should do on its own.
Yeah, let's clarify this. The Constitution gives Congress the authority to pass federal laws. A lot of people, including law professors, have wondered where Congress gets the authority to regulate immigration. And it is actually in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 10, which gives Congress the power to define and punish offenses against the law of nations. And that was understood by the founders to include trans-border migration. Congress can regulate immigration. In fact, it can also regulate emigration. The president is given the charge by Article 2 of the Constitution to, and I'm quoting here, take care that the laws be faithfully executed. That terminology comes from commissions, documents that were given to colonial governors telling them, you will enforce the law. That is the charge, the direction to the president. You will enforce the law. But that doesn't prevent other agencies from enforcing the law, in particular the states. Article 2 says that the Constitution and the valid federal laws passed under it are the supreme law of the land, and that officials in the states are bound by it. So when Governor Abbott, for example, the governor of Texas, enforces immigration law, he's not nullifying. He's actually upholding his responsibility under federal law in the way that President Biden is not.
So, Rob, when these opponents of state action to protect their borders are using this terminology of nullification, are they really trying to provoke some sort of emotional response in people who hear that? You know, are they trying to make it seem like what Texas is doing is somehow similar to what happened around the time of the Civil War with, you know, states just rebelling against federal authority? Do you think that's what they're doing? Is that the point they're trying to make?
You know, let's clarify as to what nullification actually is. Nullification, strictly speaking, is an action by the state, either by the state legislature or maybe by a state convention, declaring that a particular federal law or federal laws are inoperative within state boundaries. Nullification was first proposed by the New England states objecting to the War of 1812, and it has been a feature of American political history. I don't think it's justified by the Constitution. The most famous example of nullification, though, were the events in the late 1820s, 1830s, in which South Carolina, in particular, upset at certain federal laws, and particularly a tariff law, said that we have the right to nullify this within our borders. Again, the nullification theme raises its head from time to time and has done so throughout our history. But it is associated mostly, as you suggested, Rita, with the idea of Southern resistance against the Union. I think the reason that they use this nullification theme is it also meshes with another theme they have, which is that any effort to staunch the flow at the border is racist, you see, racist. Immigration restrictions are racist. So these images feed off each other. They have nothing to do with truth. They're simply propaganda devices to promote certain political views.
The next claim that opponents of state action make is that the federal government has exclusive authority to regulate immigration, so the states therefore can have absolutely no role in it. What do you make of that claim?
Well, that's certainly an interesting claim because it's belied by the words of the Constitution themselves. The Constitution doesn't say explicitly that the states have the right to control immigration, but when the federal union was formed, the states were left with certain powers. These are called reserve powers, and they were given formal recognition by the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. Among those reserved powers, again, is the right of a state to control its border. And in Article 1, Section 9, there's a reference to this. Basically says that the federal government shall not overrule state laws on immigration until 1808. So there was a recognition that the states have this power. There's also one thing that we haven't really touched on yet, Rita, that we need to, and we need to bring it up to the table right now. The states also have the reserve power to defend against invasion. And this is another reserve power which is recognized explicitly in the Constitution, although it would be there even if it weren't recognized explicitly.
Let me jump in here and just get more pointed on that subject, which is you hear people say that there's an invasion. I mean, certainly Governor Abbott has declared there's an invasion of Texas. But then you also hear folks on the left say, well, this is not an invasion. By an invasion, what they meant was direct military action by a hostile foreign power. And so can we get into a discussion of what actually is an invasion constitutionally?
Mark, it might be helpful to explain how and why I got involved in this. In early 2023, a co-author and I, a fellow by the name of Andrew Hyman, who's a scholar in Massachusetts, decided to investigate this question of invasion. And we wanted to know whether the current situation at the border qualified as an invasion, as the Constitution uses the term. You know, it doesn't matter what you and I think an invasion means. What matters is how the Constitution uses the term. And we also were interested in knowing how the states could respond, if at all, in the event of invasion. So we researched and we wrote an article on the subject. It appeared in this peer-reviewed journal, which is the British Journal of American Legal Studies, came out just a few weeks ago. And what we found was that the situation at the border certainly was an invasion, as the founders used the term. Now, usually the founders, like us, we talk about invasion, we're referring to a military action. But we could also use the term in a broader sense. We looked at 14 different founding era dictionaries, and 13 of them had definitions that were broad enough to include peaceful but unauthorized migration. We then looked at the 18th century literature. There are databases where you can access thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands of books and pamphlets and newspapers from the 18th century. And so we looked to see how invasion was used there. And again, it was usually military invasion, but not invariably. I'll give you one very appropriate example. In the years before the Constitution was adopted, part of Pennsylvania was actually claimed by Connecticut. And many Connecticut settlers moved into Pennsylvania in violation of Pennsylvania law. They moved specifically into the Wyoming Valley, which is where Scranton and Wilkes-Barre are located. And Pennsylvania authorities repeatedly complained about this. They referred to it as an invasion. The Pennsylvania legislature, in a resolution, referred to this peaceful but unauthorized migration as an invasion. Ben Franklin referred to it as an invasion. So it's clear that that term invasion in the founding generation could mean unarmed but unauthorized incursions into territory. And this makes sense if you think about something just happened a few weeks ago at the border. A group of migrants basically forced their way through. They weren't armed, as far as we know. They just forced their way through by main force, you know, by the force of their bodies. So one could argue that that's, quote, peaceful. It certainly was not military. Right. But could anybody realistically say that's not an invasion?
So if that does qualify as an invasion under the Constitution, the states do have the authority to confront it, right?
Yes. And this is where the next step comes about, Rita. There is a provision of the Constitution, it's Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3, which says that the states shall essentially not wage war unless they're invaded or in imminent threat of invasion. Now, what this means in international law terms is the states retain the right to wage defensive war. They don't have the right to attack Japan, right? Even if they think they've got a justifiable gripe against Japan, they don't have that right. That's offensive war. But they do have the reserve power to wage defensive war. And there are really no limits on how they can do that. I mean, they don't have to get congressional permission. They could ask for congressional help. And actually, Congress is obligated to help them under another part of the Constitution. But whether or not Congress responds, they still have the authority to use military power. And that can be quite formidable. It could mean, for example, your state, Mark, Texas, could use its National Guard. But further than that, it can use its Texas Guard. And further than that, it could actually begin conscription in order to raise an army. It could mean that Texas could, and I'm not advising this, could undertake forays into Mexico that were defensive in nature to clean out the invaders. It means that Texas can restrain those that invade, put them in prisoner of war camps, erect barriers, not in the middle of the Rio Grande, unfortunately, but otherwise. States do have this war power. It's true, I'll just finish up by saying it's certainly true that the federal government is the primary agent in foreign affairs for the United States. But the founders deliberately reserved certain foreign affairs and war powers for the states, especially when, as in this situation, their territorial integrity is at stake.
So, Rob, it sounds like from everything you've said that what is actually clearest from the Constitution, unlike some of our leftist law professors want to suggest, is that the states really do have constitutional authority to protect their borders from this invasion by illegal immigrants. But I want to ask you a normative question. Do you think that's the way this should play out? Do you think that's the best solution to the invasion at the borders, or what should happen? What should be happening?
What should happen is that the president should take his constitutional responsibilities seriously and enforce national immigration law. I mean, that's the normative. And by the way, folks, the three of us are all lawyers, and normative is a fancy lawyer term for what should be done. That's the ideal. I mean, the state having to respond is obviously a second best solution, but I don't see any real alternative here.
Yeah. You know, as a Texan, I have to say we hear a lot about our governor taking action to secure the border. And certainly he's done more than anybody else to do so. But there are a lot of us in Texas who are also very frustrated because what Governor Abbott will say and many in our legislature will say is they've done everything they're legally authorized to do. It seems to me the conclusion that you've taken us to today is there's actually a lot more Texas could do, meaning Texas could literally militarize the border. Texas could go into Mexico and on Mexican territory, fight against the cartels, kill members of the cartels, create a demilitarized zone, essentially whatever it takes to, quote unquote, repel the invasion.
Yeah, there are additional things Texas could do. And there's another dimension to this entirely, which you just brought up, Mark, and that is the cartels. And we deal with that in this particular study, which, by the way, you can get on the Independence Institute website. There is a concept of international law, and it certainly was a concept of international law at the time that the Constitution was written. And that concept is the concept of the enemy of the human race, usually expressed in Latin. An enemy of the human race was someone who, without permission from any government, simply went out on his own or with allies, a criminal gang, and pretty much waged war on anybody he could. The classic example of the enemy of the human race was the pirate. You say, the pirate owes allegiance to no government. The pirate preys on shipping wherever he finds them. And because of that aspect of piracy, the pirate is an enemy of the human race. And anyone in the human race, any sovereign state, any individual, can wage war on pirates. But pirates are not the only enemies of the human race. Generally speaking, the category includes transnational criminal gangs. And we're talking here specifically about the Mexican cartels. Part of Texas's or any state's defensive war power is the ability to wage war against the cartels wherever they can be found. Even in a foreign country, even if a foreign country is harboring enemies of the human race and does not take action against them, then other countries can do so. A classic example was the way the United States went into Pakistan and killed Osama bin Laden, who was another example of an enemy of human race. Right. So Texas authorities or the authorities of other states under invasion would have, constitutionally anyway, the authority to go into Mexico to clean out the cartels. I should make one thing clear. It's estimated that about 30% of Mexican territory is not controlled by the Mexican government.
Wow.
It's controlled by cartels. It's controlled by criminal gangs. And so I suspect that many Mexican officials would actually welcome an invasion like that because these criminal gangs are a huge headache for them as well.
That's really troubling. Now, Rob, I want to ask you one other question. We mentioned the fact that the Biden administration is really not doing its job. It's not enforcing our laws in this area. But is there anything else that Congress can or should be doing to confront this crisis?
One aspect of the Constitution we haven't mentioned yet is the Guarantee Clause. You'll find this in Article 4, Section 4. And by the way, I'm mentioning these sections. I'm not trying to show off. I'm mentioning it because I know your audience has got a certain number of constitutional wonks, and you're going to want to look it up for yourself.
Yes.
So the Guarantee Clause is Article 4, Section 4. And it says several different things. First, it says that every state must have a Republican form of government. Secondly, it says that when a state is invaded, the federal government has the obligation to protect it. And it also says when there's domestic violence within a state, the state legislature, or if the legislature is not in session, the governor may demand that the federal government protect against domestic violence. The obligations in the Guarantee Clause are not requests, they are obligations. There is an affirmative obligation on the federal government to protect the states against invasion. Now, I don't know enough about congressional procedures or congressional strategy to suggest an approach here, but it does seem to me that there at least should be some resolutions or some other actions introduced in Congress acknowledging the federal obligation to stem the invasion and somehow putting pressure on the Biden administration to do so.
Well, we are about out of time. Rob, before we go, I know that a lot of our listeners and viewers are going to want to know where they can find some of your articles and research and follow your work, which I highly recommend. Could you just tell people where they can go if they want to find some of your materials?
Sure. For a general access to all my works, including the amendment stuff, you can go to independenceinstitute.org. That's independenceinstitute.org. Click on the Issues tab and go to Constitution. And you'll come to the Constitution webpage, and there are links that will navigate you to virtually everything I've written on almost every subject, it seems.
Yeah. Rob, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Rita. Thank you, Mark. It's great to talk to both of you again.
Great being with you again too, Rob.
As we close, I also want to thank our generous sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services, Blessings Christian Bookstore, Sunshine Ministries with Christian Radio, Wishing Well Florists and Travel Services, and our friends at New Beginnings Church and Garber's Church of the Brethren in Harrisonburg. Thanks everyone for listening. If you want to make a donation to help keep Crossroads on the air, you can do so by check to Crossroads at P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, Virginia 22803. I'm Rita Peters with Mark Meckler, inviting you to join us again next week for another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet.